part of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. Okay. The first case for oral argument this morning is JB Enterprises Appellant versus the State of South Dakota, acting through the Department of Transportation, Appalachia. For the appellant, JB Enterprises, we have Mark Meyer-Henry and Christopher Healy, attorneys from Sioux Falls. Mr. Meyer-Henry, I understand you'll be presenting this morning.
I will, Your Honor.
Very well. And for the appellee, Ms. Carla Engel, a Special Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. With that, Mr. Meyer-Henry, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, this is a property case that involves eminent domain. And I would like to start with a time-honored analogy that's used when we talk about property cases. That's called the bundle of rights that comprise real property. What the essence of this case is about is this. If you will note the caption of this case, the state is the plaintiff. So this is a takings case initiated by the state. And what happened here is that the state took the stick of the bundle of sticks of my client called access to a public highway from two lots. The state took that stick, still owns that stick, and my client has not been paid for the stick.
Do you have the stick to begin with? Do you have the right to the access? Is that a property right?
Of course, it has been held so, and the entirety of Chapter 31.8 designates and recognizes that there is a right to access to a highway or a street, because we passed, as part of the series of cases in 1963, including, as we pointed out, the right to quick take property, which did not exist in this state until 1963, we have always designated the right to access is a stick that goes with everybody's home and business that abuts a street until the state or someone does something to take it away. It is a right that you can sell, and it is a right that the state can take and has taken in this case.
But the rub in this case is that I'm struggling with, when the state amended the plans, so they didn't take the full stick anymore, did they?
Well, you have to read, well, first of all, the law is absolutely clear that when you take the stick via a quick take, it's irrevocable. This court has held that. This court held in the first Ritchie case, there's two State versus Ritchie cases, one of which I have cited. The second one I found, very frankly, after all the years working on this, yesterday preparing, there's a second Ritchie case, 296 Northwest 505. This court has held that the taking, and let me jump to that here, the taking, and I want to read it to Your Honor, the taking in this case is not the plans. That's the first thing that we have to understand, because this court, through Justice Wolman, long ago has said that, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that, the state has no case that they've cited in their brief, you'll note, anything different. Here is the taking. I'm referring to the appellant's brief, the appendix, tab 2, page 14. And I want to read what the Declaration of Taking says. The Declaration of Taking is a unique document that was created by Congress and adopted by our South Dakota Declaration of Taking Act. What it allows is the state to take one of the property rights or the entire property before there's a trial and the payment of just compensation. That did not exist in South Dakota till 63, when we adopted the statutes I'm going to be relying on. So the Declaration of Taking is when Secretary Bergquist, with the power from a resolution from the Department of Transportation, in effect, creates what I call a land transfer deed, declaration of taking, from my client of the right of access to their property. Here's what it says, quoting from the Declaration of Taking, attached to the petition, covered clearly by the statutes and required. It says, they are taking what's described in Exhibit A, tab 2, page 14. It says, description of the control of access of that portion of the project which lies within the west 115 feet. If you would be so kind as to look at the state's map, which it attached to its brief, you will see that lot 18 is the west 115 feet. So that's lot 18. Description of the control of access of which lies within the west 115 feet of lot 18 and all of lot 19, except for the west 42 feet. That is what the state took. What this court said in the first Ritchie case, that cannot be altered. There are statutes of the state that says that cannot be altered. That's the taking. That's the transfer of the property right which the state described and took.
All right. Mr. Meyer Henry, following up on what Justice Zinner said, that with the amendment of plans where they allowed access, my question is going another step. If the state this afternoon came in and decided that they're going to fill in that access and just put a curb there, under the state's theory, then, and the taking, would they owe you any compensation based on that? Because they'd already taken it, and it was already in the register of deeds that was a taking that they'd already paid for, in essence.
That's why I invite you, and I'm shocked I didn't find it. That's why I invite you to read Ritchie 2, which I haven't cited. Ritchie 2 covers that. Ritchie 1 reversed the trial court, because in Ritchie 1, the trial court didn't allow any amendment of the plans or any evidence. Okay? So the court in Ritchie 1 said, in that case, let me talk about the facts, because that's important. That evidently, there was a drainage ditch. Okay? And the drainage ditch cut off the remainder land from the highway. And so the state, after the taking, okay, they described the physical taking, as I just read to you. They had one of those. They changed the way they constructed within the easement they took for this drainage ditch. So instead of this ditch fronting this lot that was all open in a ditch and you couldn't drive over, they put a driveway over it, evidently, from reading the decision. That changed at the jury trial the amount of compensation. Okay? But it didn't change the taking. Remember how we try condemnation cases. The landowners paid for the taking and any consequential damages. What Ritchie 2 said is that it went to the consequential damages. Okay? And they went back and tried it again, and of course the state appealed again. And this appeal was because the landowner pointed out that the description of the taking that landmen and lawyers would look at in the future, as this court pointed out in Morris, okay, just decided by this court unanimously, in Morris they would look at what they took. In this case, they took right of access. In that case, they took an easement that no one could drive across unless the state at their will allowed them. And in Ritchie 2, that very issue was brought up, to answer your question, Justice Severson, is the landowner expert said, you know, a landman would know, and a willing buyer would know, that driveway was just the grace of the state and could be taken away at any time. They could build a fence and fence off their easement. Well, here that answers the question.
Wouldn't they have a haul claim, what I call a haul claim, our last haul case? If they change the actual situation from what happened at the time of the taking to later on, it would seem to me that they'd have a whole claim.
Your Honor, Justice Inner, today, if someone were to go to any competent real estate lawyer and the Millers would attempt to sell them lots 18 and 19, that real estate lawyer would read Ritchie 1, would read the statutes which say when you use the declaration of taking, it is irrevocable. And knowing that, you would look at the land record and say, well, today, as I stand here today, the Millers do not own and cannot sell access because the state took it away in 2012 and they own it today. There's a driveway there, okay? Just like there was a driveway in the Morris case and it's open. But this court has said once the control of access vests in the state, and that's done, that case is done, like this case is done as I stand here, you can't come back again. So the end result is, if the day you render a decision in line with your question and say, well, you can do something in the future, and we should file a lawsuit, the state would, as they argued in Morris successfully, say, that was all taken care of in the past. We own the right to control access. They have no right to any access at all.
Mr. Meyer Henry, did they reduce the scope of the taking by leaving open the curb cut on Cliff? And so that's not, they're not ever going to take, are they ever going to take the curb cut on Cliff, or has the extent of the taking been permanently reduced in its scope?
The answer is they have not closed it. As a matter of evidence before the jury, they can say we haven't closed it yet, but the property right they took is the right to control access, for which today they paid nothing. They own the right to access, or the right to control access. The Millers cannot say to a buyer of their property, if they were to sell it, you have the right of access. They would have to tell them that your access to 63rd Street, if you would go to page 5 of our brief, please, and look at that, that the access to 63rd Street has been taken. The access to Cliff Avenue has been taken. The state controls the access. At any time, they can close it. So to answer your question, the very day the ink's dry, should you zero my client, so to speak, they can close it. They can close both of these driveways without compensation because they own the right to control the access, which means today it's open, tomorrow it's the will of the state.
All right, just to keep things clear, and this kind of gets into the companion case, I'm afraid, a little bit, but you just said that the right to access to 63rd Street was taken. That's still open, isn't it? Now,
no,
63rd
no.
is...
Well, the intersection at Cliff and 63rd is closed.
Please, Your Honor, go look at, grab the state's brief, please do that, and turn it to page 30, okay? And look at the layout. If you can see what I'm holding up, see this little jog here? If you draw that line up straight, that's lot 18, all right? That lot 18 is 115.5 feet wide. The reason is a little part of lot 18 was sold with another lot, okay? They took, now go read what the state's declaration of taking says. They took the control of access on the west 115.5 feet of lot 18. They have taken all the access to that lot right here. And they further took all access to 19, which is all the access to 63rd Street and all the access to Cliff Avenue. And frankly, they control the access off all of this property where the line is drawn. So in answer to your question, as we stand here today, there is no access to be sold because any access of this land, legally landlocked property, is over neighbors. So today, the access stick, Remember, the stick. They have the stick. It's not in my client's bundle anymore.
I misunderstood. I thought they retained access to 63rd through that other driveway.
Well, if somehow you were misled, that's not true. I just told you.
Okay.
You learn stuff as you get ready to argue. Believe me, I learned two things. Although it's in our brief that we mentioned they had taken access to the west 115 feet of 18, I don't think it dawned on any of us. I don't think even the states argued that. There is no access to 63rd Street. They took that as well. So don't confuse the other cases in this whole area. From Perkins, the Perkins access is gone. It's gone to Cliff Avenue, and it's gone to 63rd Street. Those two sticks, one from each property, the state owns, and the statutes say it's irrevocable. Now, they change the plans. That's damages. We get a jury trial. State can say, oh, we haven't done anything. And we're going to have to, we have the burden of proof. We're going to have to overwhelm that. But the trial judge was confused because the state confused the trial judge about who owned the stick. And the trial judge says, well, you haven't closed the driveway. Not yet. What about tomorrow or the next day? And the standard, we all know, is a willing buyer and a willing seller, neither being under compulsion, both being knowledgeable. That's what Ritchie 2 says. A knowledgeable landman or woman, like the court or any of us, would say, well, the law says right here that when you use a declaration of taking, a quick take, there's a trade-off because the Constitution requires it. The Constitution, prior to the United States Supreme Court rulings and the federal law, said the government can't take property until you have a jury trial, compensation is determined, just compensation is determined, and the government pays. Then it changed. In 63, we changed the law. And if you read these statutes, you cannot find, unless you overrule three statutes, that says when the waiver of the right to contest, which was done here, when that waiver was filed on June 13th, 2012, two things happened. The sticks vest in the state. That's why I confidently say they own it. And the landowner got an IOU that said you get paid for the sticks, okay? The trial judge said our IOU is no good. But they own right to access. And any person reading this record, like we just went through and your honors paid attention to our briefs and ruled in Morris, this is over, okay? This is over. So if here what we're saying is the trial judge got it right. The trial judge got it right on the first half of this case. She found that the sticks irrevocably vested in the state. What she got wrong was the legal concept that the right of access resides in the state and can be used at any time in the future. They just haven't closed the driveway yet. But a willing buyer and a willing seller, you're not going to pay $2, $3 million for a Perkins location when the seller says, you know, after you check drives, the state could come in with a great big truck and dump one of those barrier things across your driveway to Cliff Avenue and 63rd Street. And not only is 63rd Street closed at the end, right here, the declaration of taking says your access to 63rd Street's gone, and your access to Cliff Avenue is gone. That's the situation my client is faced today. And yes, the driveway is presently open. Is it a ruse? I don't know. I don't know what's in the mind of the state. But I know that the state had years to decide, because these parties negotiated for years, the city was involved. The city or the state had years to decide to use the declaration of taking. And when they did so, the secretary, Darren Bergquist, used to be a lawyer, was the top lawyer. He knows what this says, and it says, for example, 3119-35, cited by Justice Woolman. A proceeding to condemn land for public use may not be abandoned after a declaration of taking. That's a statute.
What about the two statutes that allow, the quick take statutes that allow compensation to be adjusted up and down depending on the actual situation? The amount that's deposited might be deficient or it might be too much.
Judge, that's after our jury trial. We haven't had any determination of what we should get paid for the sticks. The judge kicked us out of court.
Doesn't that tend to show that we need to look at the actual situation on the ground rather than...
Yes. That, if you reverse the trial court and we get a trial, when they appeal the next time, you will see that the state argued the driveway's open. We haven't closed the driveway yet. No, they shouldn't get all this money. They should get a little money. And you will see me calling witnesses to say competent, intelligent people that buy restaurant property aren't going to offer a penny for this. And we're going to hash it out. The jury will make a decision. Then we'll find out what it's worth.
Your time has expired, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Engel, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court and counsel, I'd like to begin by addressing Justice Zinter's question and also your question, Chief Justice Gilbertson, concerning the taking. And it's very important to understand the differences between this case and the Ritchie case. And the differences, frankly, are significant. In the Ritchie case, the government unilaterally amended the plans, but not the pleadings. That's legally significant because what the government was taking had not changed. Simply how they were going to use it had changed, and the consequential damages that might result from that taking had changed. In this case, the state, through a cooperative effort with the landowners that is documented throughout this file, worked and collaborated with the landowners to change the taking. And the government not only amended the plans, but amended the petition. And that amendment is significant. And I would ask your honors to look carefully at the original petition, which is attached at tab 1 to the landowner's brief, and the amended petition, which is attached at tab 5. And you will find in the original petition that we pled that we were taking the right-of-way and temporary easements as shown in the attached resolutions of necessity. And those resolutions identified control of access to lots 19 and 18 as shown on the plans. And the plans, in turn, showed control of access across Cliff Avenue, not control of access across 63rd Street. So in our original petition, we were condemning the access rights to Cliff Avenue, but not to 63rd. That's what the plans and the resolution showed. In the amended petition found at tab 5 of landowner's original brief, you will see no reference whatsoever to any taking of control of access or temporary easement, no reference whatsoever to the original resolutions of necessity acquiring those rights. Instead, you'll see a reference to the amended plans. And the amended plans show no control of access across the frontage of the Perkins property. And it's important for the court to see, it's Appendix 26, it does not show control of access extending across their frontage. And so the Ritchie case, which Mr. Meyer Henry rests his argument on, does not apply because it doesn't deal with the statute found at 312937, which empowers the government and the landowners to change the taking even after the filing of a declaration of taking. And that statute even specifically acknowledges that that can be changed even if there has been a declaration of taking filed. And Mr. Meyer Henry doesn't address that statute for you at all or explain how his argument can be reconciled with it. And in addition, Mr. Meyer Henry has suggested to you that that declaration of taking is irrevocable. But that's not true. It's not true because it wouldn't jive with this statute, which is found both in state and federal law. But Mr. Meyer Henry urges you to consider the case of Catlin versus United States. He cites it in his brief, and he identifies it in his index as one of the three most important cases for this court to consider. And I certainly agree. And I would urge you to take a look at that case because it really undermines the argument he's now making to you. And the reason it does is because in that case, the federal government filed a declaration of taking to take certain property from the landowner. Under the federal law at that time, the mere filing of the declaration of taking vested title, along with a deposit, would vest title to that property in the government. Well, after the declaration of taking was filed along with the condemnation papers, the landowner sought to challenge the government's authorization to condemn the type of property that they had condemned. And they claimed that the government lacked the authority to condemn that property. And so the question became, how can a landowner possibly make that kind of challenge if title has indefeasibly vested in the landowner as of the filing of the declaration of taking? And the United States Supreme Court explained that. And they said the title that vests in the government is a defeasible title, one that can be annulled or avoided based on the landowner's subsequent actions and agreements. And so what the court said is, from the fact that the government may become irrevocably committed to pay, it does not follow that the owner is irrevocably committed to submit to the taking. Title is not indefeasibly vested in the United States merely by following the administrative procedure.
All right, but that's talking about defeasement of title by subsequent action. In a quick take, are you contesting that the title has transferred to the state upon the waiver executed by the landowner?
No, we're actually making two arguments. The first...
Well, tell me one of them then.
Okay.
Isn't the title now in the state?
No.
It's not?
No. And the reason is twofold. Number one, this statute, 31-1937, authorizes the parties by agreement to reduce or eliminate property that may have been or may be taken by or on behalf of the state of South Dakota by declaration of taking or otherwise.
Well, what does that do to the constitutionality of the quick take statute then? I mean, the reason for the constitutionality being upheld is that they are paid up front.
That's true, but in this case, number one, there was never a valid waiver, but number two, that court deposit, perhaps you're confused, Your Honor, about whether the court deposit got released. The court deposit was never released.
No, but they signed the waiver.
They signed a waiver which they immediately disavowed in correspondence with myself. So they signed a waiver, but number one, that waiver was never valid because they explicitly disavowed it in correspondence to me on the same day as the date of the waiver. And number two, under the statute, even if that waiver were valid, the statute allows the parties to agree to eliminate the taking.
But they've never agreed, have they?
They
wouldn't sign your stipulation. They have indicated in their correspondence that they feel that it may reduce the scope of the taking, but not eliminate it.
And I appreciate your question, Your Honor. The stipulation was for complete dismissal of the case. And they indicated in subsequent discussions, which are memorialized in our correspondence and which are consistent with the discovery that followed, that they believed that the construction of the median, the closure of the access point, connecting 63rd and Cliff Avenue, and the construction of a turn lane within the existing right-of-way, that those three actions still constituted a taking. And so they were unwilling to stipulate to a complete dismissal because there were still those issues that separated us. And for that reason, the department did not move for dismissal, but instead amended the petition to eliminate the acquisition of access control, eliminate the acquisition of a temporary easement in order to remove their approach, and instead incorporated the revised plans that contained those other aspects of the project. And we even, in correspondence with Mr. Meyer Henry, said, those are the issues that now separate us. And in fact, that was what the discovery was. Their own witnesses never said that all access has been taken. Instead, they talked about how the loss of access due to the median, the loss due to the closure of the intersection, and the loss due to the construction of the turn lane affected those properties.
So are you conceding today that the state of South Dakota has no legal right to cut off the access to this property?
That's absolutely right. If we had not amended the pleadings, we would still be taking control of access. And even if we constructed an approach, we still would have taken those property rights from the landowner. Now, it's a bit confusing because I think the circuit court confused curb cuts with access rights. And I want to be very clear to this court, the department never argued that they were the same. Our position was and is that the parties agreed to eliminate the taking. Otherwise, what effect would the amendment of the pleadings have had? What effect would their failure to oppose the amendment or object to the amendment have had if it were not intended to eliminate those acquisitions?
Well, how would you reconcile the fact that your own expert valued the loss of access when you close the intersection at Cliff and 63rd? Your own expert talked extensively in the appraisal about that value.
Well, and in his appraisal, Your Honor, number one, an expert's opinion isn't dispositive. Number two, he was looking at the effect of the acquisition of access control from the landowners coupled with no corner street, no nearby street. So he had to recognize that not only were they losing their frontage access, but they were also losing any side street access that they might have had because we were closing that intersection. So he properly looked at it. I would not be saying that he should ignore that and not consider the fact that they'd have no direct way to get to Cliff Avenue.
But your view is now that that's completely not compensable, as there's still a curb cut on Cliff open and this back access through 63rd.
Well, not compensable. In addition, it's not just a curb cut, Your Honor, but they have full access rights. There is no acquisition of access across that frontage because the amended petition indicates that there's not. And Mr. Meyer Henry suggested that, well, there's a cloud on title. That is not the case. The only filing with the Register of Deeds, and it's attached to Mr. Meyer Henry's brief, is a notice of lis pendens. That's it. There's nothing indicating that we've acquired control of access. A person examining the title would then go and look at the court filings, and what they will find is an amended petition that does not acquire control of access or any temporary easement from these landowners.
Backing up just a second, I'm not sure I heard you correctly, but did you say that it was proper to value the closure of 63rd? I thought that's what I just heard you. Your appraiser, I thought you just said that it would be okay, that your appraiser valued diminution in value of the property because of the closure at 63rd.
No, I'm not saying that the closure of 63rd is compensable. But the appraiser has to consider all of the entire situation affecting the property.
But that makes it compensable if you figure the value of the property is worth less because 63rd's closed. That's compensation. That it turns into compensation, doesn't it? I'm not following you there.
If there had still been an intersection at 63rd Street, There may be an argument made that there was still reasonable access because of access to the abutting 63rd. But that's not the situation that was presented to the appraiser. The situation that was presented is all access rights across 63rd and no intersection that would have given nearly direct access to the property. And I believe it's appropriate for the appraiser to consider that fact. Would it be compensable? No. We have the power to eliminate intersections. But if we had left open that intersection and acquired control of access, could the appraiser consider that fact as a mitigating factor in determining whether or not they still had reasonable access to Cliff Avenue? Yes, he could have. But that's all hypothetical. The situation that we have here was they would have no avenue for direct or near direct access to Cliff Avenue. He had to take that into consideration in determining what is the effect of the acquisition of control of access across the landowner's frontage. What is that effect? So it was proper for him to take into account the fact that there would be no near direct access either because of our intention to close that intersection. But it's not compensable. I believe that's evidence of how the acquisition of control of access across the frontage would have affected the landowner, if that makes sense. I'd like to next address Mr. Meyer Henry has made the assertion that we acquired control of access to 63rd as well as Cliff Avenue. There's two problems with that assertion. Number one, that's not what the plans show. There is no control of access shown across 63rd. We have no power to close to, we have not acquired those access rights, so we don't have absolute power to eliminate that access point. And number two, that's a new argument that was never presented before the circuit court, and I would urge the court not to allow that argument to be brought forward.
Well, the documents have to speak for themselves. I didn't anticipate this, so I haven't looked at it, but we're going to go back and look at what the Declaration of Taking says. And now you're saying it did not eliminate access on 63rd?
That's right. They had an approach that led from lot 18 to 63rd, and the plans do not show control of access across that. The plans show control of access across the Cliff Avenue frontage. And I can also explain why lot 18 got added in addition to lot 19. Lot 18 was part of the larger parcel. It's part of the parking lot that was used for the Perkins. Originally, the resolution of necessity only referred to lot 19 that directly abuts on Cliff Avenue, but lot 18 was clearly used for the same purpose. If we hadn't added lot 18 in the resolution of necessity, there would have been some argument that we'd only partially condemned the property that was going to be affected and damaged by the taking of access to Cliff Avenue. So the amendment of the resolution of necessity to include lot 18 relates to the acquisition of access to Cliff Avenue, as is shown in the plans.
Now, you were saying that there was emails and a waiver. Aren't those fact questions that are going to have to be decided? This is summary judgment. If there are fact issues, then the court was wrong in granting summary judgment, was it not?
But the record speaks for itself. The record is what it is. And so those documents are all in the record. And so there's nothing more to be added other than what the documents have to say about the issue. And no one's disputing that the documents were exchanged. So I would say that that issue does not require a reversal for additional facts. In addition, the larger question really is, did the parties agree, even if that waiver were valid, let's assume for a moment that it was, which is not something we're willing to concede, but let's assume that it was. What was the effect of all the subsequent discussions and then finally the amendment of the petition to eliminate the acquisition of access control? What was the effect of that? Mr. Meyer Henry is essentially asking you to ignore it. ignore it.
Was there an order? I can't remember. Was there an order entered approving or allowing the amendment?
Yes. Yes, there was, in February of 2013. And by the way, in the memorandum that was submitted to the court where we asked for the amendment, we very clearly stated that we were eliminating the acquisition of control of access and the acquisition of the temporary easement. And that is found at tab 4 of Appley's brief.
But you still took and you still took access by closing the intersection at 63rd and Cliff.
No.
And your view is they're entitled to no compensation for that closure.
We did not take any private property rights when we closed the intersection. It may have damaged the landowner, but it's damage without legal injury and is not compensable. And that's because they had no private property right in a public highway intersection.
What case do you rely on for that proposition primarily?
Darnell and Henriksen. And Darnell?
Darnell was creation of a new highway.
Yes, a new controlled access highway. But the court, in that opinion, talks about the government's ability to control the flow of traffic. And that's what this is about. It's about the flow of traffic from one public highway to another. Does a landowner have a private property right in how the traffic flows from one street to another? And there are cases in other states holding they do not, because the loss of that intersection is a loss that is suffered by all members of the public. Everyone loses that convenient route of travel, not just the landowner. And so they can't show the special injury that's necessary in order to prove the acquisition of a private property right.
One more question, if I could. But this property owner suffered consequences in addition to the public because of the diminution in the value of the land as a result of the closure of 63rd.
May I, Chief Justice? The diminution in the value of the land, that's damage, but it's not legal injury. And in order to show a compensable damage, a landowner has to show a peculiar injury, different in kind and not merely in degree, from that suffered by the general public. So just because your damage is higher than what the public suffers doesn't translate to a compensable injury. And I would ask Mr. Meyer-Henry to identify any case in this nation where a landowner has been compensated because a public highway intersection has been closed. I have been unable to find any. But I would be interested to hear if he has found a case that supports that point of view.
Thank you, Ms. Engel.
Thank you.
Mr. Meyer-Henry, you have 10 minutes. I guess my opening question is, after hearing Ms. Engel's presentation, you got your access to Cliff Avenue back.
I don't think so. Right. I don't think, Your Honor, this court has the jurisdiction or power to do that. I'm just telling you, I've thought about that. I thought this question might come. The statutes and the legislature has clearly defined, if you use a declaration of taking, what's to happen. And let's back up a moment, Your Honor, just for a moment. Where are we at here? Judge Sabers ruled there was a taking, okay? You wouldn't think that from the argument of the state. So it is the state's burden to convince you that Judge Sabers' finding of fact and conclusion of law was wrong, that all of these emails, and I want to refer to your rules, Supreme Court rule, it's now codified, 16-18-11. And it has to do with the state's claim that I, as the lawyer for the Millers, somehow stipulated and agreed to anything. Judge Sabers found that did not occur. This tells you what evidence there is in the record and what can be used. The evidence of a stipulation The Supreme Court made a wise rule way back when, back in 39 or sometime, to say, we're not going to have lawyers arguing as we do here, where one-sided communications say, as you agreed, as you agreed, as you agreed, which is their argument here. It says right here, an attorney in consort law has the power to bind his client to any agreement in respect to any proceeding within the scope of his proper duties and powers, but no evidence of any such agreement is receivable except the statement of the attorney himself, his written agreement signed and filed with the clerk, and an entry thereof upon the records of the court. None of the emails from Ms. Ingleside are at all relevant and should not be considered, and we don't need to have a hearing back in front of Judge Sabers because there's been no showing, which is it had to be clearly erroneous. And Judge Sabers, although not, did not cite this rule, it's clearly true. There has been no written agreement. There has been no signed stipulation agreeing to anything that revested or divested my client's claim to compensation for what the state did.
What's the effect of the amended petition then?
There is none, except at the trial to the jury, the plans have been changed. The taking hasn't been changed. There was no declaration of taking changed. The judge has found today, it's the law, that the declaration of taking vested, as the statute says, vested the title in the state and vested the right to compensation of my client. A petition, I had thought the law was clear. The filing of amendment pleadings, and that's what a petition is, it's pleadings, does not mean that if the state files an amended murder case, the defendant agrees if they waive contesting the filing of it, because the rule is it's always granted. I think everybody here has been a trial judge. How many times did you deny the amendment of pleadings? No, the argument about what the problems the pleadings cause come later. That's here. That's what's going on here. We're in a way arguing about the pleadings. Not that they could file them. You can always amend your pleadings in South Dakota. We all know that. It's gentlemanly, to say, no, we don't need to have Miss Ingle drive all the way and argue and say, we want to amend the pleadings. Because to amend the pleadings does not bind the parties to what's in the pleadings. You've got to have proof. You've got to have law behind it. So it's somewhat of a ruse and a little aggravating with such important things at issue. As we stand here today, it's no doubt in the state's mind that this property, according to their evidence, is worth $1.1 million with this detriment. But they convinced Judge Sabers, who got confused, to say it's not damaged at all because we haven't exercised the right we own. The stick we own, we just haven't slapped them with it yet. Well, they have a right to do it.
What about the argument that you didn't accept? You didn't file a valid waiver, or if you did, you withdrew it.
What more can you do? If you look at the waiver I filed, I don't know what else you could do not to do that. And there is no doubt there was confusion in this case, as there is in every case. State doesn't do this all the time. But here's what the waiver, well, the waiver's here. The court can read it, but it's a waiver like any waiver. It says we waive the right to contest the taking. The landlord didn't contest the taking. And the statute says, and I'd like to read it just very quickly because it's so important, about vesting. In real estate, vesting is important. It's when the right, the ownership, passes. And when it vests, and the statute says it vests upon the filing of the waiver, okay? And there's no written stipulation where the landowner divests that right to compensation. So when that vests in real estate, that means the ownership is in another party. And the waiver that was filed doesn't need the approval of the state, has nothing to do with the state. And the Kaplan case that was cited, and the state seems to think it helps them, that's what this is about. We have two things going on. You read the statute. The title vests and the compensation vests on the first of one of two things, a hearing held to challenge the taking. If you look at the record closely, I filed a motion, I noticed the motion to challenge the taking, withdrew it, filed a waiver. If you go read the rules in the law, it says either act, having a hearing and the judge denying or approving the right to take the property, or the waiver. The landowner here chose the waiver. At that point, the state has nothing to do with it, just like the landowner has nothing to do with the declaration of taking. That was done behind closed doors in Pierre, signed under oath by Secretary Darren Bergquist, shipped over to the legal department, and served on my client. When the waiver happens, the legislature said, these have vested. And I don't believe, with all due respect, and with most respect to the court, I don't think you have the power to divest it, and she certainly, in oral argument, doesn't have the power to take away the vesting of the right to compensation by saying we've left it open and we're not doing anything right now.
So your view is then that the trial court should be reversed and the case should go back to determine what the actual situation is now in light of the amended petition?
No, we did that. All the arguments you heard, that was the ruling on the right to take. Judge Sabers has decided that issue.
And so your view now is that the trial court should be reversed.
Should be reversed.
And the case should go back for a determination of a jury trial to determine your damages.
Correct.
Under the amended petition. I mean, determine
the actual situation. Ritchie 1 is clear. Ritchie 1 says, the footnote says, and it is not, with all due respect to Ms. Engel, it's clear what Ritchie says. You can't amend the taking. Okay? The taking here is this nebulous thing called control of access, but they have taken the access thing. If we go back, as I beg you at the end of my time, to send it back, the state has not proven to you by clear and convincing evidence in the record that the judge was factually wrong to say there was a taking. What I'm hoping is that you apply the law, which says once there's been a taking here of the right to access, you get a jury trial, and the jury will determine the damages. And they will be able to say, we changed the plans. We've left these driveways open. And we will say, but they can close them tomorrow. And then the jury will say, what would a willing buyer and a willing seller agree to be the price today, or on the date of taking, June 13th? And that's how this case should end. We should get our day in court. They can go on. We changed the plans. We're wonderful. We rode in on our white horses. Just what you wanted. No, it's never been what we want. We didn't want them to do the project at all. And the evidence that's in the record shows, even with this driveway open, you've destroyed the business. At the time of the summary judgment, this business has lost money every month since this project. But that's for the jury. That's for the jury. That's what we're asking for. What the Constitution of both the federal and the state Constitution require, and the statutes require, is a jury trial to determine the amount of compensation of the taking, which I've read to you, which is the law. And Judge Sabers said that was taken.
Thank you. Your time has expired.
Thank you very much.
Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.